Hi, everyone. I'm Josie Schaefer. This is Academics of PA, our podcast talking about all things public administration. Well, mostly just academic public administration. And we are so excited to be joined today by Michael Ford. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Josie. How are you doing?
I'm so good, and I'm so glad that you were able to jump on with us today. Why don't you introduce yourself?
Yes. So as you said, my name is Michael Ford. You can call me Mike if you want to, though. It doesn't matter to me. I am an associate professor of public administration at the University of Wisconsin, Oshkosh. I also serve on the Oshkosh Common Council, so I'm a practitioner in that regard. And then I'm also the president of the Midwest Public Affairs Conference, which I know we're going to talk about a little bit today. And that takes place this week in Springfield, Illinois.
Wonderful. Thank you. And thanks for all you do. So let's jump in with Midwest Public Affairs Conference. You took over a couple years ago. What is the conference all about? I know it was hard during COVID. So how are we coming back strong?
Oh, it was really easy during COVID. We just canceled it. That was one of the best conferences I ever had. I got no complaints about those two MPACs that were canceled. MPAC is the Midwest affiliate of ASPA, the American Society of Public Administration. And it was founded by Stephen Kleinschmidt, who's at University of Illinois, Chicago right now. But we're a very developmental conference. My hope for MPAC was to make it something where the work really was the focus, something that was easily accessible, where folks could travel there without flying, something they could drive to. So really lean into the fact that it's Midwest, work focused, and always on campus, and trying to go to places that normally don't host conferences. And that's one of the reasons we're going to the University of Illinois Springfield this year. If you don't know Springfield, Illinois, it's actually surprisingly cool, especially if you like Abe Lincoln. But we have a good group of about 75 folks that are going to be there later this week. And the theme of the conference is reinventing. I should know the theme, shouldn't I? I think it's reinventing the administrative state. But really, if you look at the conference agenda, we have a lot of stuff focused on what comes next in public administration. So both post-COVID, but also post some of these challenges to democracy we're facing in this country. So it's going to be a fun time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think everyone does like Abe Lincoln. So that's cool.
They
getting
do.
To check that out. I think we first met at MPAC in Omaha, right?
Yes, absolutely. It was in Omaha. Yes. And Omaha is a great place. And that was a great conference, too. So I'm hoping that we can bring MPAC back to Omaha. But we'll talk about that.
You're more than welcome anytime. I'm sure. I know John Bartle will be there. So
yes. I should say too that your fine institution is one of the lunch sponsors, I believe, on Thursday. So we will all be eating thanks to the fine folks at UNO.
You know, let me tell you, Omaha folks in Omaha eat well, so I'm not surprised that we're sponsoring a lunch.
This is true.
Omaha likes to eat.
I went to a fancy steak dinner at that MPAC, and I remember not having the money for it because my wife had gone back to school. But you know what? I went for it. You only live once. And
we have cheap steak here too.
This is true.
We have all of it.
Well, I know. Go ahead.
Now, what made you interested in being president of MPAC?
Well, Stephen asked me to do it, so that was a very that made it very easy. But no, in all seriousness, I do like to say yes to things. I you never know, right? I want to make the most of every situation I get myself into. So when Stephen asked if I'd be willing to try it out, I said, sure. And I thought, yeah, 2 years. Now it's year four because the two got canceled. So it was a little more than I bargained for. But I really like the idea of a regional conference. One of the things that I've struggled with as an academic is going to some of these conferences where you feel like you're walking through Walmart. And there's nothing against Walmart, but you feel pretty anonymous when you're at these places. And I really struggled as a professor at a regional comprehensive institution where we didn't have many resources for travel and that type of thing. And some of these national conferences were just cost prohibitive. So I really wanted to do something that was affordable, accessible to graduate students, and just easy to get to for folks that don't have those resources. And I think that we've pulled that off.
I absolutely think you've pulled that off. And I think students do get really excited about these smaller conferences on a campus where they can do more than just put information out, but really get feedback and spend time with folks and feel really comfortable networking. And that's probably what I always loved most about Impact 2.
Yeah, and just, yeah, not being uncomfortable. And that was one of the things I went to, and there's nothing, I have nothing against PMRA. That's a great conference. But my first time there, I was a new academic and folks wouldn't give me the time of day. It was really intimidating. And I just didn't get very much out of it. And I really wanted to create an experience for those younger folks in the academy where they did get something developmental out of it and really set themselves up for some career success and some connections with some really, really nice people and hopefully some job opportunities.
Well, that is amazing. So I happen to know that your trajectory into the academy is kind of interesting. And I think this podcast, it's a little bit about what we do, but it's a lot about how and why we do it. Yeah. So can you share with others how you came to do this work?
Yeah, purely by accident. If I'm totally honest, a lot of it has to do with spite.
that's what really drives me as well.
So I was working at, I worked as a lobbyist on education policy stuff for years in Milwaukee and in Madison, Wisconsin. And one of the things, and I went to this, you know, met with our umbrella organization that was based in Arizona at the time. So this National Education Advocacy Group, and they had a new president there. And I don't think this president, he didn't last very long, so he won't be listening to this, so I can say this, but I didn't think he was very impressive, but I noticed he had a PhD. So I said, okay, maybe that's the secret. Maybe I need to go back to graduate school. And I was very lucky that University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee was about a half mile from where my office was. So I was able to very easily go to class after work. I was able to teach a course over my lunch break because I had a really cool boss. And didn't really know if I wanted to go into the academy, but I knew I liked learning. I went to grad school part-time at night. I was really focused on the practitioner side of things, and it just sort of happened that there was a transition in my workplace when I finished my PhD, and the job at Oshkosh opened up, and it was the only one I applied to, and it just kind of worked out, timing for my family and for my career.
What would be your advice to other PhD students or folks thinking about a PhD program? Should they sort of risk it all and see what happens? Or do you think it's a pretty unique circumstance how you came?
I think that I was probably pretty unique. We're all special, right? I learned that in school. I always read these things on Twitter when they're like, you know, never pay for your own graduate school. And I'm like, whoop, made that mistake. And I keep a running tally of all the mistakes I made along the way. But I will say, do it works for you. It worked for me to do it that way. I like to have multiple things going on at one time. I had a young family, full-time job, and it just kind of worked out for me that way. And in a way, I wasn't taking the risk that some folks take when they get their PhD, and that I already had a good career going that I honestly really thought I was just going to keep doing before I made the plunge into academia. So in that regard, the risk wasn't huge for me, but the reward ended up being pretty huge. But I think folks need to have their own path, and especially a practical field like public admin. I do wish that we prioritized a little bit of the practitioner experience more. I think there are places that do that. But if you talk to individuals that came out of the practitioner world, they usually have some really good research ideas and they usually had a really good experience. So I'd love to find more structures where we encourage that and recruit from the practitioner base into our PhD programs.
Sure. Well, so did you start off researching topics related to you being a lobbyist? Do you still draw from those experiences a lot? How did that inform what you're doing today?
Oh yeah, 100%. So I really, the way I got my PhD idea was I was working on these education issues and folks were talking about how useless school boards were. And I was kind of like, well, is anybody studying these things? And I really, there wasn't much out there, especially in the public admin world. So much of it was in the ed policy world. And my whole thing was, if you look at what school boards do, it's not that different than what city councils do or village boards do. And it's more of a governance exercise, something that folks in public administration ought to be studying. Yet we were kind of yielding this territory to the ed policy world. So I was yielding all these complaints at the state capitol about school boards being ineffective, but there wasn't much evidence there. So that really did inspire my dissertation on school board governance, trying to understand, you know, who serves on these school boards? What exactly do they do? Do they do it well? Trying to put the brakes a little bit on some of this advocacy work, that we should get rid of school boards or they should all be appointed, and say that, hey, maybe we should learn about them before we start making these wild policy assumptions and jumps. So that's a long way of saying yes to your question, Josie. 100%. I mean, everything I've done on the research side has been informed either by relationships I have with folks that are in practice, or things I've encountered in my own career on the practitioner side.
So what about the flip side of that? And you are an elected official now.
Yes.
How well do you see academic work, yours as well as others, informing practice, informing lobbyists, informing elected officials, local government officials?
Yeah, not much.
Your whole passion, right?
Right. And that is, I should have said this in the introduction, but this last year, myself and Dr. Samantha Larson, who, if you don't know Sam, she's the greatest human being that's ever existed. In all seriousness, Sam is awesome, but she's the deputy director of the Whitburn Center for Governance and Policy Research. And we started this Applied Research Center to try to get at that very disconnect. And one of the things in particular that we notice is that a lot of our graduates, and we have about 600 graduates from our MPA program at UW-Oshkosh, awesome. Most of them are working in Wisconsin in some level of local government management. And they didn't have many resources. And the research that they were connected to either came out of the consultant world, which I'll just bite my lip on that one, or it came, right, this stuff that was just too esoteric or too geared towards large municipalities that didn't really apply to them. So I shouldn't throw the entire enterprise under the bus, because certainly, right, there is academic research that's informing, I think, a lot of the things happening in our larger municipalities and in our states, et cetera. But our local places, especially our smaller places, I found that there was a huge disconnect between the research they needed to do their jobs and the research being produced. I don't know exactly why that is. I think there is something to be said for the lack of incentives for doing that type of work. Sure. In the academy, especially at your R1 institutions. So I do think there's a little niche there that can be filled at regional comprehensive or other places that maybe are that more next tier of universities that can maybe afford to do some of this more practitioner work.
So as in your life as an elected official, you know that this information is out there. Maybe some isn't, but you're well aware of what is being done.
Yep.
How do you, I would find that very difficult, right? The more you know, the more you don't know kind of feeling, right? So now
yes.
Here I am, I have to make a decision. And I'm so aware that I'm doing this without full information. Does that frustrate you? I think that would drive me crazy.
Oh, yes, it definitely does. It does frustrate me. And I think the bigger challenge, and this I did not expect, and this is because I'm a naive, simple guy, I guess. But the fact that I was a professor of public administration was not an asset in certain people's eyes, certainly in the community, saying that here's this guy that he's got all this fancy book knowledge. He's going to come in and tell us how to run a city. He doesn't know what he's doing. He's never been on the front lines. So I think a big challenge, a logistical challenge in applying some of these academic research principles was presenting it in a way that was humble, presenting it in a way that ensured that you were out there looking for feedback and not working under the assumption that, hey, here's what the evidence says, so this is the direction we should go. I really think that the evidence and the research that's out there on things like we have an equity initiative in the city of Oshkosh that we passed. And I think it's great that we did it. It's supported by high quality public administration research, but actually getting it done required a lot of groundwork and just listening to make sure that we're matching some of this academic evidence with the realities on the ground and the values of the community I represent. So again, another very long-winded answer, but just trying to get across that I think the way in which you present academic research to other elected officials, city staff, residents is as important as the substance of that research.
Yeah, I think I found that to be true in my work as well, right? At this point, I'm more focused on how it gets presented than what gets presented. And, you know, 2-3 years ago, I wouldn't have said that would be the focus of someone at a research center. But there is a lot of research. We just don't share it very well. Right. We just don't connect it very easily. We don't say things like, here's what the research says, but you really have to listen to your community first. You can't just adopt this. You have to think about what it means in your context. And there's just not a lot.
Yeah. And I do think that we can look in the mirror a little bit as academics and what we incentivize within our institutions, whether that's for tenure, whether that's financial incentives, that broad question of what counts and what doesn't count. And I mean, that's been a frustration for me. A lot of the practitioner focused work I do is a labor of love. It's not something I get any compensation for or any type of course release for or any of that stuff. But I do it because I think it's important and I love doing it. But I happen to be wired that way. I think we need to change our incentive structures a little bit to actually encourage academics to do that. And really, right, kill this notion that applied research isn't good research or doesn't count, or, right, we're ignoring the big questions, the more cognitive stuff, or, right, if we're focusing on local or state, we're ignoring the big federal issues, and that stuff's more important. We get ourselves into these little research rabbit holes where we learn a heck of a lot about things that aren't very practical. And we incentivize that type of work. And I just find that really problematic.
I agree, but no one listens to me. So.
No, they don't listen to me either. That doesn't bode well for the ratings for this podcast.
This podcast will be in the world. Hopefully people will. Yes. And it's funny, actually, in doing this podcast, it's very common that that's what people say, but we know that it's not prevalent, or like you said, that the structures and incentives haven't changed to match this thing we all really care about. And I think we all do at some level, but are not rewarded for it. So that's
great. And I don't blame anybody. I wouldn't ask anyone to sacrifice their tenure case or their career trajectory because we want them to do more applied work if it's going to hurt them career-wise. It's a matter of changing those incentives, which is hard.
Yeah. So have you changed? I would say it's probably easier to change up your classes a little bit. How has being an elected official informed what you're doing with your students to help them prepare?
Oh, I have case studies till the end of time. Which is great, but really, and this is you probably experienced this at Omaha. Our students are really impressive and accomplished before they even walk through the door. I love this. Every year we get a little survey from the university, like, did you place your students in jobs? And I'm always like, yeah, 100% of them, because they came in with jobs. So yeah, good for me. I take the credit for that. but it's helped me as a professor with credibility, because so many of my students they're living in this local government world. And I think just seeing that, hey, you're an elected official, you're participating in this world. There's things I can ask you about that I can apply directly to my workplace. It's been a real asset with some of our graduates too, who are city managers, who will often, just happened last night, will come to me if they're having issues with their common councils or their village boards and kind of just picking my brain, you know, what would you do in this position? It's also helped that one of our recent graduates also serves on the Oshkosh Common Council with me. So we're slowly taking over the city of Oshkosh, which is great, right? So we're going to be one of the most evidence-based cities in the country soon.
I can't wait to read that case study.
Oh yeah, it's going to be impressive.
And so talk a little bit about the research center too, and when that started and how it's going. What are you all working on?
Yes. So the whole idea of the research center was to try to consolidate all the work that I call it the UW Oshkosh MPA network, but really our faculty, our adjuncts, who are usually pretty impressive people in their own right, and our graduates, they're all doing this cool work. I wanted to bring it all together under a common umbrella, both as a marketing tool, but as a way to maximize our impact and really show that we can still govern in Wisconsin. And that was our mission. We were really close to launching right before COVID hit as a pretty modest research center. COVID derailed that, but I think that ended up being a good thing because it gave us a little more time to plan, but it also gave us time to secure some more funding. And we had a really generous donation from Gerald Whitburn, who is a UW Oshkosh graduate, but served high-level positions in the state of Wisconsin, the state of Massachusetts, was a private sector CEO for a while. Just a really cool guy who believed in our mission of improving governance in Wisconsin and beyond. And he set us up with 5 years of startup funds. We assembled a really nice advisory board that has some alumni, some high you know, high profile names in Wisconsin. Our board chair is the former governor, Scott McCallum. And we launched this in November of last year, I believe, formally. We had been doing work prior to that. I really wanted to hit the ground running and go with the productivity ethos that, hey, if we're going to be relevant, we got to put stuff out in the world and do a lot of it. And we did that. So we released a report on local control very quickly after we were launched. We did another research report on the local government response to COVID-19, trying to learn from the mistakes that were made and the successes that occurred. But then also started an event series. Once a month on Wednesday, we have an event that's usually a panel of alumni that are working on topical issues. So we had one related to the public sector response to the opioid epidemic. We had one on navigating the public sector workplace. We had one on recruiting more women and more gender equity into high-level positions in local government. We're going to continue doing that. But we also were able to hire two student employees, provide tuition incentives to one of them, have a fellowship program for our alumni working in smaller places to get some professional development resources. So really trying to use this as a vehicle to take that research that we are doing, whether as faculty or with our alumni base, and putting it out there into the world, all while creating opportunities for our students. It's really been a fabulous thing for the first year.
Does your energy ever run out? Can you stop? Do you know how?
I was talking to my mom about this over the weekend because she came to visit. And I just, my mom and I used to fight all the time, and it's because we're exactly alike. This is going to sound very morbid, but my philosophy is, eventually we all die, Josie, so I might as well do as much living as I can. The energy will run out someday, but not yet. So I'm going to keep going.
Oh my gosh. Running a research center, that kind of outreach, pulling in those foundation dollars, having an advisory board and keeping them happy. This is all a lot of work. And what do you teach? 2-2? 3-3? I mean,
that's funny. A 2-2. I didn't know. Does that exist? That's like a myth. That's a myth. I'm the chair of the department now, so I have become this kind of living, breathing course release. But as many places, we have resource challenges where we've had to go above and beyond teaching. So we were at a 4-3. That's kind of our starting point. But right now, I'm teaching two classes over the summer. Then I'm usually good for 2 or 3 a semester.
You are an impressive guy. So, well, building on that, advice for young faculty, students, you're very prolific with research, you're chair, you're a director, you're an elected official, you have all this practitioner experience. What would you say to folks that would love to be able to do everything you're doing and doing so well? Your research, by the way, I don't think it gets enough credit, but anytime I read it, I go, oh, wow. Yeah. That's really interesting, right? And it has a very, it's very contextual, right? Places difficult concepts into a much bigger picture. And it really, I learn from you all the time, Mike.
Oh, well, thank you, Josie. That is one of the nicest things anyone's ever said to me. I don't know if I'm crying or sweating because it's 100, it's 100 degrees here in Oshkosh today. So probably a little bit of both, but no, that's very, very kind of you. What advice would I give to people? Find what moves you and what motivates you. I found very early in my academic career, and I really did try really hard to kind of be the full academic. I was kind of like, yeah, I'm going to apply all the only R1s, see if I can do this. And I bought into a little bit of this world that the practitioner world's not really, they're doing the best they can. But if we can make this unbelievable research breakthrough, that's going to be more important long term. And that's how you establish your career. But that did make me happy. So I kind of pivoted towards what I enjoyed and the questions that moved me. The questions that moved me weren't always the questions that produced research that ended up in the highest quality journal. But there's enough venues out there where you're able to place things, even if, right, not everything has to be in JPART, not everything has to be in PAR. And that's okay. And I've come to appreciate being at a regional comprehensive university in that it did give me more freedom in ways that I don't think I would have had at an R1 university. Now I can see, maybe I'm lying to myself, right? It's really easy to say I wouldn't have had those opportunities when those opportunities were never opened for me, despite my best attempts. But I really do appreciate the freedom to have a really broad research agenda, and folks that are willing to say, yes, you know, go for it. Like, so when I started this idea for the research center, and we hired Sam Larson, and she said, yeah, let's try it. Right. She still is pre-tenure. She didn't have to do this. But she was open to it. And part of the reason was that, hey, you know, I was able to lay down that this is what the goal is. This is going to produce both academic research and practitioner research, and I'm going to be upfront with you, right? The goal here is to really focus on practice. And if you're in, that's great. And being at a regional comprehensive, you're going to be able to meet your tenure requirements doing some of this work. And certainly it's been great to be part of a department that has valued service beyond university service. So a lot of this community stuff, it does count towards tenure and can count towards promotion and all the things that we worry about as academics. So again, another long way of saying that I just want people should do what they like, lean into what they're good at. I'm rereading right now Richard Rousseau's Straight Man, which hits really close to home as a board chair. If you haven't read that book, it's all about the insanity of academia at times. But one of the things that he points out there is, you know, he names his dog Occam after Occam's razor, that we can aspire to these things, but oftentimes we end up doing what we're meant to do. Or if you were going to write that incredible book, you probably would have written it. Maybe you didn't write it. And that's not a negative thing. Lean into what you're good at. Find what makes you happy. There's not one way to do these things, and the grass is not always greener.
And you're very modest, right? You're from Wisconsin. You get to be in Wisconsin. You have a lovely family in Wisconsin, right? I think a lot of folks have decided they have to give up their personal life to pursue this R1 academic life. And you're modest, but I'm pretty sure you chose, right, at some point that you were going to have.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I've been married for 17 years. My wife's from Wisconsin. My kids love it here. I've really learned to love it here. I'm from Illinois originally, Josie. Keep that in mind.
I did not know that.
No. Yeah. Yeah. I keep moving north. That's the running joke with my siblings. Like, you're going to be in Canada soon, Mike. I said, you know, maybe could happen. But yes, no, I have been extremely, extremely lucky in that regard, that I've been able to stay close to family, been able to continue to pursue opportunities related to my kind of my previous career while being an academic. And my wife's a nurse practitioner. She went to grad school here in Wisconsin right after we moved to Oshkosh. I mean, she's the breadwinner of the family, so I'm just kind of on her coattails. But if you ever do a podcast on nurse practitioning, especially related to opioid epidemic, because she does addiction medicine, she'd be a great guest for you. But yes,
that sounds really cool. I don't know what I would ask necessarily, but I'm down. I'm open.
Yes, excellent. You should have Allie on there. But the point I'm getting at here is that, right, we forget sometimes that it's a career, right, at the academy, but it's also a job, and it's okay. That doesn't have to be your whole life. That's okay.
Yeah, I have seen that. Right, we saw that in the workforce post-COVID, and I have now seen it come to sort of academia, right? We all have to make some choices in this career, and right, they don't pay us enough to make really terrible choices. So I think it's great advice. I think it's very timely advice to kind of stick to what you love and stick to places you love and just do really well there.
Yeah.
I laughed when you said you would have written the great book already if you were going to write it.
I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but I think there's some truth to that. I had a friend in college that she wanted to go to law school so bad, and she kept getting horrible scores on the LSAT. I didn't want to be a jerk, but part of me is like, well, maybe that's telling you there's a different path for you, and that's okay.
Right. That is great wisdom to leave those junior colleagues and lots of folks. And I think, mid-career folks too, right? Like,
yes.
Don't let it beat you down. Find a path that's right for you. And I think there are more now, right? Like, there is not one way to do this job really well.
Oh, yeah. And I that's been encouraging. And just know there's opportunity everywhere. I had so many people that were like, oh, you're going to a regional comprehensive, like your life's going to be hell on earth. I'm like, actually, it's a pretty sweet life. It's not so bad. I don't know what you think happens at these places. It's pretty nice. We have great students, good location, good opportunities. I got nothing to complain about here.
You go ice fishing, right?
I do go ice fishing. I never ice fished till I moved to Oshkosh, but we have this giant lake, Lake Winnebago. It's like 40 miles across, or 10 miles across, 40 miles north-south. And first winter here, I looked out there, there's like 10,000 people. And that's not an exaggeration. They're out there. I'm like, well, I should probably do that. I'm attracted to big, shiny objects and crowds. So I went out there walking into the abyss and figured out they were ice fishing, learned how to do it.
Is it fun?
Yeah, it is fun. You can mimic the ice fishing experience if you go into your bathroom, turn the lights off, and just fill up the bathtub and stare at it in the dark. That's pretty much what ice fishing is. But no. I'm really selling it, aren't I?
Yes, no, for sure.
I like it because it's almost philosophical. I've taught my children this because you drill a hole in the ice, and I tell my kids that, remember, things will fall in the hole. That tells you everything you need to know about life. If you drill a hole in the ice, your keys are going to go in there. You might step in there. Things are going to go wrong, but you know what? You're doing something. The weather might be bad, but you're going out there. You're getting after it, having an experience. Maybe you don't like it, but you know what? You're trying.
That is the Mike Ford we all know and love. One last plug for Midwest Public Affairs Conference. Do you want people from not the Midwest to come ever?
No, they should stay away.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
These fancy East Coast, West Coast. No, everybody's welcome at MPAC. You might find that you like the Midwest, or you might find an institution here that you like. And we do have, in all seriousness, we have plenty of people that went to grad school at a Midwest institution that are now outside of the Midwest that still come back. So certainly all are welcome. And we explore different places that you might not go to otherwise, and do everything on campus, which I love college campuses, so maybe that's just me, but I think it's a really cool opportunity to go visit some places.
Absolutely. Do we know where next year's is?
We don't. Omaha, I think, right? Isn't that what you said, Josie?
That's what I heard, no, sure. I mean, if you say it's true, it's true.
Yeah, we have a couple prospects that are interesting, so stay tuned for that.
Very cool. Well, thank you for all you do. Thank you for all of your wise words. Thanks for being a good friend. I miss you. It's been a really long time.
I know. I can't wait to see you at MPAC, Josie. You're coming, right?
Sure.
Okay.
No, I'm not.
Oh, you're not? Oh.
My research associate, Morgan Vogel, who's awesome, is going.
Okay.
She's bringing a couple of our papers. Just the timing did not work out for me.
No worries. I understand how that goes. So you will be missed, but I look forward to talking to Morgan.
Yeah, I was hoping to not tell you. Well, Mike, thank you so much. Thanks for your time. And it was great talking to you.
Yeah, great talking to you too, Josie. Thank you for your work and for doing this as well.